1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be also heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. One can call in to WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest this afternoon is Linda Fairstein, lawyer, former New York City prosecutor, and best-selling author of The Mysteries About People, Sex, and Violence in the City of New York. Welcome, Linda, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the message of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. And obviously, the prosecution of sex crimes and the rights of women are a very critical public policy issue in America. Linda Fairstein is an author and a former New York City prosecutor who focused on sexual crimes of violence against women and children. She served as the head of the sex crimes unit of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office from 1976 until 2002. She's the author of a series of novels featuring Manhattan prosecutor Alexandra Cooper. The novels draw on her legal experience as well as her knowledge of and affection for the rich history of the city of New York. She's a native New Yorker who was raised and educated in Westchester County, or in fact, our neighboring town, Mount Vernon. She graduated with honors from Vassar College and the University of Virginia School of Law and joined the Manhattan District Attorney's Office in 1972 as an assistant district attorney. She was promoted to the head of the sex crime unit in 1976, and during her tenure, she prosecuted several controversial and highly publicized cases, including the Preppy murder case with Robert Chambers, the Central Park jogger case. And she left the district attorney's office in 2002 and continued to consult, write, lecture, and serve as a sex crimes expert for a wide variety of print and television media outlets, including CNN, MSNBC, Larry King, etc. She has consulted for many media outlets during a number of high-profile prosecutions, including Michael Jackson, Kobe Bryant, Scott Peterson trial. She was the founder of the Domestic Violence Committee of the New York Women's Agenda. She's a frequent speaker on issues surrounding domestic abuse. And in her long career, she never pictured herself staying in a position for nearly 30 years that she did. It's sort of remarkable. And she loved her work and is part of the sex crime unit, and she enjoyed being part of the changing laws and scientific developments surrounding sex crime prosecution. In fact, probably all the fans of SVU would and all the spinoffs would see that as a testimony and a testament to Linda's work. You know, legendary New York City District Attorney Robert Morgenthau Jr. promoted Linda Fairstein to serve as the head of the office's newly created sex crimes unit at the tender age of 28. Morgenthau, after many years as a U.S. attorney for the prestigious Southern District, was first selected in 1974. And he thought your appointment would help earn women's trust in the system with regard to sex crimes. Linda, how did you initially feel being not only one of the few women in the department, but to be elevated to such an important position at such a, let's call it a tender age?
Thank you for that very generous introduction, Richard.
My pleasure.
To your question, it was such a different time, as many of your listeners will remember, generationally, for things that were possible or not for women. There were simply many professions that were not open to women, and law, especially criminal justice, was among those. I was hired out of law school in 1972 by Frank Hogan, who was the legendary DA before Morgenthau, there about 28 years at the time. And Frank Hogan, simply, as great as he was, simply did not believe that the courtroom was an appropriate place for women, talking about violent crimes, talking about blood and guts. He just didn't want us there. So there were 200 lawyers in the office when I joined, and seven were women. We were mostly in the Appeals Bureau doing writing legal briefs on cases to argue before the higher court, but never in front of juries and not doing violent crimes. So it was the early 70s, it was in 1974, 2 years after I got to the office, that Hogan had been persuaded to set up a special victims unit because the history of these crimes all across America was a bad one. We had such archaic laws inherited from the Brits that just the smallest number of cases could go forward because the evidence requirements were so stringent. And when the unit was created, I had nothing to do with it. I was still too junior, 2 years in the office. The head of it left when Morgenthau took over. And so in 76, Morgenthau was faced with this new unit and the desire to change laws and make them better. And what you said, I mean, he thought it would be important to have a woman figurehead. It wouldn't happen in this day and age that he would go to somebody 3 years out of law school, but that's what he did. So I had a little bit of experience because I'd handled some rape cases, and not nearly as much as the senior men in the office. That was his choice, simply to encourage women to identify with the young women who were beginning to do this work and bring them into the office. When I look back, if I'd been 40 years old with the maturity and the wisdom that it brings, I don't think I'd ever undertaken the job and would not have accepted it. But he asked me to do it, and I really didn't have any choice. I did not think it would become a career that I loved. It was such dark work at the time.
Well, but, you know, Bob Morgenthau is an incredibly legendary figure, a war hero, a famous family name. He finally retired in 2009 at the age of 90, and after 35 years on the job, which anybody could handle, is amazing. And you served basically in his office for 30 of those years. After all that time with his bigger-than-life personality, you actually knew Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Right.
What were the changes you saw in him, and how did your relationship mature?
Well, I was a 28-year-old, I would say, kid at the time. He was in his 50s when he took the job, and so he had behind him the great reputation as United States attorney. He had the family reputation, his father, Secretary of the Treasury under FDR, and grandfather, ambassador to Turkey, who'd saved the Armenians from the, or tried to anyway, right, spoke out against the great slaughter at that point in time. So the family was revered, and Morgenthau was revered. And the fact, because he took me out of the general office routine of young lawyers and elevated me to be a bureau chief so early, I had just stunning access to him from the earliest point in time. And one of the things that just amazed me when I would go in as a lawyer unknown to the outside world and talk about a case that might be a headline case in the New York Times or might have a groundbreaking legal issue and ask permission to go about it as we saw fit, he never micromanaged it. And his response, he said, was what Bobby Kennedy had taught him when Bobby Kennedy was Attorney General and Morgenthau was U.S. Attorney. And he'd just look at me, 28, 29, 30, say, do what you think is right. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I then got to teach all the young lawyers that who work for me. Don't do the politically correct thing. Don't do the easy thing. If you think it's the right decision to prosecute, even though we may lose the case, let's give this victim a day in court if we have all the evidence. If you think the wrong guy has been identified, do what you can to make sure that's made right and that he's not tried. So from the earliest access to him, the lessons were extraordinary, and I think they helped me mature as a professional much more rapidly than I would have.
Mm. We have our last question before the break coming up. You know, you were a child of the 1950s and went to college in the turbulent middle 1960s when women's rights started to emerge. You know, in your lifetime, you witnessed the transition of young women from being primarily thought as first a wife, a mother, to being gradually allowed to the top schools, the best graduate schools in the previously male-dominated professions. What were your impressions regarding this change, and how tough was it to break into the old boy network and get respect?
in different pockets of it, it was very tough. After Mount Vernon High School, a great large public high school, I went to Vassar, which was an all-women's college, and we were sort of bred then to think you could do anything. So it wasn't hard coming from that single-sex college to think you could take on a lot of things. And it was quite a shock to see what male-dominated professions these were. So among my colleagues, among the other prosecutors, I was the only young woman in the entering class of a dozen. Those guys were great to me. They were my age, my generation, and willing to give me a chance. The older judges and the defense attorneys, I mean, I think it was a more ageist thing where they just had never seen women prosecuting these cases using some of the language that you had to use doing this work. And there was a good deal of resistance from many of them. Others, and there were only a few women on the bench at that time, they were great to me. I mean, they reached out and they'd call me up and say, you're not doing this right. Here's a better way to introduce this into evidence. So there were individuals who were enormously helpful. And then sort of when I got into that senior a position, I had so despaired of not having women pals.
Linda, we have to go to a slight break. We're coming up against a short financial news update. I want to remind our audience, you're listening to Advocates on WVOX 1460 and live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is Linda Fairstein, former New York City prosecutor, head of the Sex Crimes Unit. She's also the best-selling author of the latest book, Silent Mercy. We'll be back in a second, and we'll continue to pursue this line.
Business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, stocks reversing earlier losses, moving higher along with rising oil prices. They're offsetting concerns about the global economic recovery. Just past noon Eastern, the Dow's up 37 points. Shares of Martha Stewart OmniMedia rally after hiring a private equity firm, the Blackstone Group. The company has been approached about partnership and investment deals. The move also allows the company to explore other alternatives. Founder and namesake Martha Stewart is expected to return to the board of directors during the third quarter. And French Finance Minister Christine Lagarde announcing her bid to become the next head of the International Monetary Fund. Lagarde has become the frontrunner for the job and would be the first woman to run the IMF. She would succeed Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who resigned after his recent arrest in New York on sexual assault charges. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Robert Gray.
If you're thinking of investing your hard-earned money in the stock market, I have one word of advice for you. Stop! Wall Street lost over 45% of your money twice in the last decade, and they're about to do it again. An eye-opening free report reveals the secret Wall Street doesn't want you to know. How to grow your wealth safely every year and never lose a penny, even when the market crashes again. For a limited time, you can get this report free at bankonyourself.com. That's bankonyourself.com.
Call us crazy.
You're crazy.
But we believe radio should be delivered free of charge.
Are you crazy?
Go ahead. Listen all you want. It's free. WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD3.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guest, Linda Fairstein, novelist and former New York City prosecutor. We're talking about a career before she became a best-selling mystery writer. In the post-war World War II era, women went back into the domestic role they were confined to before the war, when the shortage of manpower affected the American workforce. But many of them never forgot the image of Rosie the Riveter. As women moved into the hurly-burly of the formerly all-male workplace, sexual tensions and gender electricity grew. Linda, how did these laws change regarding the physical abuse cases and the sexual crimes towards women over this time period in the post-war era?
It really came, Richard, as a result of the grassroots women's movement. It was not at all identified and addressed from, sadly, I think, within the criminal justice system. It was not judges and prosecutors who said, we're denying women access to the system. Our laws in every state required that there was additional word in the sex crime beyond the victims. This crime least likely to be witnessed by anybody else required an eyewitness, medical evidence long before there was anything like DNA identified as a forensic tool, and the recovery of the weapon. So it helped for women, sadly, to have injuries, which is what we try to avoid. And so it was really the grassroots movement in the 60s. Many women who had survived these crimes, they began to agitate for reform. And the first changes in the laws, the major changes, eliminating this additional evidence we call corroboration, eliminating that requirement, instituting rape shield laws, those all occurred in the early 1970s, mid-1970s, coincidentally, serendipitously, just as I began to do the work. So I benefited from those changes, and then my unit under Morgenthau began to lobby for even more change. But mostly it came from outside the system.
Mm. You know, as women minorities emerged into the workforce and moved up the ladder to the councils of power in corporate America, men started to feel the loss of their own power and influence. Linda, has this translated into a more conflict regarding the battle of the sexes, and has this tension led to more sexual violence?
I'm not sure it's led to more sexual violence. I think there has always been an extraordinary amount of this violence in this country and in many, many countries, in many places throughout the world, most societies. I think we didn't speak about it till the 60s. You can look long and hard in the New York Times archives to find stories about sexual assault before the 1970s, because it was a very taboo crime. Mm. I would say that what that power dynamic that you talk about is more ever evident, I think, in sexual harassment cases where women entered the workplace and took traditionally male jobs, and so there's definitely more of what you ask about in that setting than I think in particularly the violent crime.
And of course, crimes are now reported in terms of whether it's harassment or, sexual abuse. You know, speaking of sexual crimes, in the last 15 to 20 years, the Roman Catholic Church has been involved in various civil actions, jury rewards, voluntary settlements approaching $4 billion to victims of sexual abuse. Has justice been generally bought off by these billions in hush money? And have police departments and prosecutors left too much to church discipline and civil action?
Well, we could do an hour on this, Richard. Prosecutors and police have left a lot to church discipline because we had no choice. I was given these cases in the early 1970s, and the church, being the bureaucracy it is, would simply transfer. The first case I had was a priest in Inwood with a teenage boy. And when we went after, started the investigation to go after and into the church to talk to witnesses, they just moved this priest. It took us 6 months to find him. He was transferred to Austin, Texas, and we had no extradition, no way to get him back because he had not been charged. If any of your listeners saw the A1 New York Times story last week, which kind of got lost in the DSK rape scandal, just a stunningly ignorant report issued, ordered by the Catholic Church, that suggests that the sexual revolution of the 60s is what's responsible for the mistraining, misguided church training of the priests, as opposed to the fact that this conduct went on long before the 60s and continued long after the 80s. So it's a huge area of concern. And yes, the church has been drained with this close to $4 billion amount of settlements. Parishes, sadly, out of operation in this country. Fewer and fewer young men entering the clergy. It's on every side a terrible thing.
And, you know, it's interesting, reflective of that study that came out. Do you think that was a cop-out? How does the public, your peers, the people you talk to, think about that article?
Well, we all thought that it's wonderful for the church to say they've hired John Jay College, an independent tribunal, to do this study, but they were only studying the church. And you can't do that, I think, fairly without talking to law enforcement, without talking to victims of these crimes. The church defined pedophiles, victims of pedophilia, as children under the age of 10. Well, most children under the age of 10, in reality, are not going to church alone. It's really the 10 to 15-year-olds who are the altar boys in the youth choir, the ones who were to whom the clergy had access. The overwhelming number of clergy are great, but the bad priests had access. And so the church doesn't even count the thousands and thousands of kids who were adolescents who were most at risk for this kind of abuse. It's not five-year-olds going to church alone.
And it seems like in law enforcement, quite often the cover-up is almost worse than the crime. In this case, I'm not sure, but it certainly exacerbated the situation and certainly put it off. It certainly kicked the can down the road. And it certainly, if it was dealt with in the early days, the loss of prestige, the loss of incredible amounts of money, the loss of people that wanted to join, you know, this honored, you know, profession for life, certainly wouldn't have occurred, it seems to me. We have to go to a break for a commercial. I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is Linda Fairstein, former prosecutor, current consultant, lecturer, and best-selling mystery writer. When we come back from our break, we're going to discuss how she transited from a very active public career in law enforcement to being an internationally famous writer of New York City-based mysteries, which features her alter ego, it seems, Alexandra Cooper. We'll be back in a moment or two. Thanks.
National news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Ron Flatter. The severe weather that killed 13 people in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Kansas spared Joplin, Missouri yesterday, but the city devastated by Sunday's tornado may be in for more.
Now as I stand here, the clouds are once again are in the sky. The wind is picking up and the forecasts say bad weather could be rolling in here in the next couple of hours. So the search and rescue effort again picks up kind of a frantic pace as they want to try to wrap all that up before more bad weather rolls in.
Fox's Mike Tobin in Joplin, where 122 people have been confirmed dead. As the cleanup continues, weather watchers are adding up what happened yesterday.
47 reports of tornadoes, 183 hail, 277 wind damage reports across the nation's midsection and across the mid-Atlantic.
Fox News meteorologist Janice Dean. In west central Missouri, a tornado warning is in effect for another 15 minutes in parts of Cass and Jackson counties. This is a Fox News alert.
Just over the Westchester line in downtown Greenwich, there's a spectacular new dining venue, Gabriel's Italian Restaurant. At number 35 Church Street, owner Danny Gabriel has created a warm, stylish restaurant with a great becoming wood-burning stone fireplace. A perfect setting for some of the best food Greenwich and nearby Westchester has ever seen. The hand-selected prime steaks, seasoned with sea salt and crushed peppercorns and seared to perfection, are the real deal at Gabriel's. Plus all your favorites. Thick-cut onion rings, cream spinach, and Chef Joseph Giordano's mind-blowing pasta creations. And best news of all for all diners in our area, the gracious Tony Capasso for years at Valbella is now heading up the dining room at Gabriel's. For reservations, directions, and a very special welcome from Gabriel's maitre d' Tony Capasso, call 203-622-4223. Gabriel's on Church Street in Greenwich. It's new and it's fabulous.
Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather is brought to you on WVOX Worldwide by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
Forecast Westchester County and the vicinity for this afternoon. We'll see plenty of sunshine. High temperatures will climb close to 80 in the north breeze. Mostly clear tonight. Overnight lows falling back into the lower 60s. Sunny skies on Thursday. Highs will range into the upper 70s, close to 80. Friday, mostly sunny. Highs will range into the middle 80s. Saturday, partly sunny. Chance of storms in the afternoon into the lower 80s. Pretty good on Sunday and Memorial Day, with partly sunny skies each day. Chance of shower, thunderstorm, highs lower 80. I'm Steve Pelletieri, Jr., reporting for WVOX Worldwide, WVIPHD.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
How about you get on the radio?
And you broadcast from room to room and even house to house.
Call David O'Shaughnessy, 914-636-1460.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. My guest, Linda Fairstein, New York City prosecutor, lecturer, political and social commentator, award-winning best-selling novelist. Linda, you retired in 2002 after 30 demanding years in one of the most active and challenging departments within the New York City Prosecutor's Office. You wrote your first book, Final Jeopardy, in 1996. Did you find yourself exposed to peer criticism because of your literary efforts?
Peers in the legal world?
Yes, in your literary department.
It's a huge office. There were 600 lawyers practically at the time that I started to write. My friends remained my friends and thought it was great fun. A lot of us have wanted to write. A lot of us have were allowed by the district attorney, not for any salary, but to talk to movie producers and television producers and novelists about what we do and scenes for the work. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there were people who, I know there were people who assumed it wouldn't succeed at the outset and so thought it was foolish. And my loyal, good friends in that office wanted to be characters and celebrated with me and have enjoyed the ride along with me.
Was there any envy that you spotted, or most of it was held close to the vest?
Oh, I don't think nothing that I saw anybody wear. I think anybody wanted this kind of transition has tried. Some of my colleagues tried to write books. Some have written books, but I didn't sense envy. I was having too good a time with both careers. I wasn't looking over my shoulder that way.
Yeah, that's, you know, there are many great mystery fans in the United States. They've been reading hundreds of millions of books from from Arthur Conan Doyle, S.S. Van Dyne, Agatha Christie, Rex Stout, Earl Dare Biggers, Earl Stanley Gardner. These are famous names, of course, and the more modern authors. Most of all, these novelists create a central character, Sherlock Holmes, Nero Wolfe, Perry Mason. Were you a mystery reader, and did any of these great writers influence your style?
Oh, I was from as early as I can remember with my older brother, who you know has been a guest on your show, Guy. He had Hardy Boys, and I had Nancy Drew, and I started with those. And then my father introduced me to Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes series, which remains to this day one of my favorites of all times. I go back and reread for the brilliance of both the character development and the way that Holmes observes and takes his clues from physical observations of people, where they've been, what the mud in their clothing suggests, and so on. So I started with Conan Doyle very early, and Poe was the other who just captured my imagination as a storyteller. Now, I don't write the way either of them do. It would be a good thing if I did. But in terms of storytelling, Richard, that's I loved to lose myself in the stories. Agatha Christie, I loved as an adolescent and young adult, and then Nero Wolfe and Rick Stout Nero Wolfe books just fascinated me. And again, they were very New York, and the characters would drive up the Bronx River Parkway, so it sort of brought me near home in Westchester to as well. So yes, I still read widely in the genre. I just love it.
You know, your marvelous word pictures describing the city come naturally as a planned element of your style, or did it grow gradually because of reader satisfaction and their hunger, you know, for more detail about New York's charm and variety? Was this something that came right from day one?
Good question. I really don't like crime novels that are just car chases and shootouts. I love to learn something when I read a book and come away, even if it's an entertainment like a murder mystery, to come away a little smarter or better educated about something. And for me, not so much in the first book, a little at the ending, but by the second book, I looked at an institution, there, a great city hospital, as a microcosm of the city, a place where 20,000 people, patients, doctors, nurses, people delivering linens, flowers, food, visitors, the population of a small town in a city institution just fascinated me. And that's when I had the idea, book two, to sort of make New York City a character itself in the books. And I didn't know how people would respond. I had no idea. And it's been a very happy thing for me, because people in and around New York, or who know it from visits, generally the mail I get is, you know, I never knew that about the Museum of Natural History. I've been going there since I was a kid. I love it. Thanks for unlayering it for me. And I get mail from New Zealand and people who say, I've never been to the States, likely I'll never get there, but I learn New York through your words, the way I'm saying now, Linda, the way I found, you know, London through Conan Doyle and traveled the continent with Agatha Christie. So it's interesting for me to do and great fun.
You know, two modern mysteries that involve public people. One, the Eleanor Roosevelt mysteries by her son, Elliot Roosevelt, which are incredibly unique, not that he wrote them all. And the Margaret Truman mysteries, which both of them were in the Roosevelt mysteries. They dealt with real people almost completely, with a few characters. Truman's didn't. I noticed there's a character in your latest book on page 208 named Justin Feldman. Is he a real character? Because a lot of the other people don't seem to be names I know. Is there some connection there?
Thank you for that question, Richard. Yes, Justin Feldman, always described as one of the best lawyers in New York, a prominent, skilled attorney, is my husband of 24 years. And, you know, if you remember the Alfred Hitchcock movies, in every movie that Hitchcock directed, he gave himself a cameo, and he'd just walk across the party scene or be the person getting on a bus. And so my homage to my husband when I started to write was to make him a character in every book in the series. So he occasionally gets a speaking role, not always, but he appears in each of the novels.
You know, that's the great poetic license that one can have, you know. And, you know, it's funny when you talk about your own experience with mysteries. You know, when I was a young boy and growing up in Mount Vernon, I noticed my mother had many mysteries, Hand in the Glove, Rex Stout, The Saint, Leslie Charteris, and, of course, Earl Stanley Gardner, who, for lawyers, that's one probably an essential. And I said to my mother one day, I never saw her read mysteries. I said, how come all these mysteries around the house, Penguin editions, Bantam books? And she said, when my brother, my uncle, happened to be in the service during World War II in combat, she couldn't sleep. And she would read mysteries all night until she fell asleep.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I always, you know, and of course she had the best of the best. And that's where I first, you know, got involved with it. Getting back to characters, how do you find, of course, your husband, Justin Feldman, comes in and out of these your mysteries. But how do you deal with all these fictional characters that may be based on real people? Do you find a conflict?
Well, you do it. I do it very carefully. If there's a real conflict or something that I want to try and explore, and someone identifiably connected with it, I may make enough changes so that the figure is obviously connected to the actual events. But I may do a gender change, age, younger, older, entirely change the personality. I'm not looking to embarrass anybody. I'm not looking to have a lawsuit.
Right.
And then I use real figures. The paperback that's just out, Hell Gate, the last year's book, has a political setting in New York. And I use the real names of people who fell from grace in political scandals. And there were a lot of them in local politics. So I only do that when the facts are firmly behind me and there's either a conviction or an admission and a step down from office. But otherwise, I love to use my imagination, and I draw from motives and real characters, but then I always reimagine them.
You know, of course, and any casual reader who would know you particularly could see Alexandra Cooper easily as your alter ego. I'm not so sure they could see Robert Morgenthau as District Attorney Battaglia, but and I'm pretty sure you've made it. you purposely kept that distinction. But as I said, it's fascinating. This is so many people are interested in this, and so many people are great fans of this genre.
Yes.
We have to go to a break for a commercial. I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX.com with my guest, the novelist and women's advocate, Linda Fairstein. She has a different hat on than prosecutor today. We'll be back in a moment or so.
And national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. President Obama reaffirming U.S. ties with Britain. Speaking before both houses of the British Parliament, one focused the importance of global leadership.
We must always remember that the true source of our influence hasn't just been the size of our economies, or the reach of our militaries, or the land that we've claimed. It has been the values that we must never waver in defending around the world.
He's the first U.S. president granted the honor of speaking from Westminster Hall.
The president ends his U.K. visit with a dinner tonight that he'll host in honor of the Queen.
Fox Radio's Mike Mankiewicz, the brother of figure skater Nancy Kerrigan, acquitted of manslaughter in the death of their father, the defense maintaining that Daniel Kerrigan died of heart disease. And search crews frantically looking for survivors after storms swooped through the nation's midsection, leaving at least 14 dead across Kansas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Our community programs are brought to you today by Young & Bartlett, Westchester's leading law firm for negligence, personal injury cases, and medical malpractice. Relying on 55 years of legal experience, partner Francis X. Young and his legendary father before him have been great advocates, recovering millions of dollars for those unfortunate individuals who were injured in any way, including victims of medical malpractice, construction job site accidents, motor vehicle accidents, or defective products. Young and Bartlett are actual trial attorneys who stand right up for you and your rights in the courtroom. Partner Mayo Bartlett of this top-notch firm also specializes in civil rights cases and criminal defense. Calling on his many years as assistant DA under famed crime fighters Carl Vergari and Janine Pirro. Today, Young & Bartlett is at 81 Main Street in White Plains at Lexington, two blocks from Metro North. Attorneys Frank Young and Mayo Bartlett. Two great lawyers, two dedicated advocates. Check them out at young-bartlett.com or by calling 914-285-1500.
Hi, this is meteorologist Steve Pelletieri from Ion Weather. It's springtime, and summertime is coming up quickly, but you still may have bills or have to bill for this past winter's snow and ice removal services. If you need past weather data for anywhere, take this number down, 1-877-267-8255. 800-516-8807 for past weather data or snow totals from this past winter. Now, this weather data is not free, but the information provided will solve problems. When kind of problems, answering questions, like what the weather was for past accidents or slip and fall investigations, or how much snowfall fell and when. For law firms, insurance companies, and construction companies, and snowplowers and property managers alike, call toll-free 1-877-267-8807. Ion Weather data and storm totals. We just made the weather a little easier to manage. Ion Weather. Call toll-free 1-877-267-8807.
For most individuals, just 30 minutes of physical activity 3 days or more a week can help reduce risk factors for deadly conditions such as heart disease, high blood pressure, and diabetes. Body movement that uses energy such as walking, biking, and swimming can change your status from couch potato to mover and shaker. So what are you waiting for? And as a reminder, Soundshore Medical Center encourages you to check with your healthcare provider before starting any exercise program. And for a copy of Soundshore's free brochure on physical activity, call 365. 3597.
You've been cooped up all winter.
Go to the window, open it.
Smell that fresh air.
Experience the excitement of spring with WVOX Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guest, author, consultant, lecturer, novelist, Linda Fairstein of New York City, a real New Yorker. You have been writing mysteries featuring Assistant District Attorney Alexandra Cooper for 15 years now. You know, many writers have always struggled with the aging of their central character and the obvious change in both their locale and times they lived. You know, Nira Wolfe from the 1930s through World War II and up until 1974, almost 40 years. How have you dealt with this obvious problem of the aging of New York City, the change in its institutions, and the youthful vigor of your principal character?
Good question. The change in New York City is one of the things that fascinates me the most. I love taking sites that have been built over and how quickly we forget what the history was before. And so sometimes, literally, I'm in the underground. I did a book about the Great New York Public Library, which was once a reservoir with water pumped in from Croton and Westchester, and before that was a potter's field, a Revolutionary War potter's field. So there were bodies that had to be removed before the underground stacks, the floors of underground stacks of the library had to be built, which is a sort of creepy thing that does well in the murder mystery.
Right, macabre a bit.
Yes. And so the city's change is helpful to me, actually. The aging of the character, I say with a big smile and laugh, is a lot more difficult. So I've chosen not to age my protagonist, Alex Cooper, in real time, so that every year she's not getting a year older as the public gets a new book. It's sort of 2 or 3 months between capers, because from my point of view, I'm trying to keep her in her 30s, single, very active in the courtroom, doing things that some characters have now aged out of, as some of my literary peers have done the real-time thing.
Mm. You know, over 100 years ago, the first master of the detective novel, Arthur Conan Doyle, got tired of his hero Sherlock Holmes and finally killed him off. You know, and of course, it's more difficult for you. Public opinion demanded his return, and he was resurrected back to his domicile at 221B Baker Street. How many years does Assistant District Attorney Cooper have left? And have you ever felt like she was getting rid of her? Or, you know, or is
she hasn't, right? She has not bored me yet. I know that, having read a lot about Conan Doyle, that he literally became bored writing the character. And I think I have so many other things going on, and there are so many issues evolving in the field that she deals with. I mean, just this last week, the fact that an A1 top of the fold New York Times story is the rape of a chambermaid in New York by a world figure economist politician. And I love exploring, I love entertaining in these books, but while I do it, exploring real social dynamics. So maybe because there's a lot of me professionally invested in my character, I'm not tired of her yet, and I have lots of ideas spread out ahead of me.
Well, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. If you wrote a novel about that, they'd laugh at you.
Oh,
you know?
Over the top. My editor would say, not possible.
Sorry.
Over, you know, calm it down.
Sorry.
Do something more realistic.
Right. You know, Ian Fleming, the great author of the James Bond series, Earl Stanley Gardner about Perry Mason. Ian Fleming was a spy. Earl Stanley Gardner was a lawyer, you know, in California. And their characters are sort of their alter egos, too. The problem is with many of these adventure stories, of course, was ending it. Have you had a problem after you create all this, you know, internecine web? Do you have a problem bringing this to a conclusion in a way that is as interesting as all the web in creating it?
Ooh, that's a very good writer's question. I am one of the writers who goes to the ending, creates the ending as soon as I have fashioned the beginning. Once I decide who my victim is and what's the motive for his or her death, then I immediately, I don't write the ending, but I figure out who did it and why. Now, some of that's prosecutorial, and I want to get the right guy and not have an exoneration, and so it's a little controlling that way. But I really think it's essential for ending well. A lot of these books don't end well.
Right.
And readers in this genre are very critical. They're smart. They like to have clues presented to them. They don't like the killer to open a door on page 398. You've never met him before,
right,
and he just said, I did it, and here's why I did it. So I am concerned with how the book ends. And there are characters in my genre who carry guns, and so 9 out of 10 books end with the gun just coming out and somebody being shot.
Mm.
Alex Cooper doesn't have a gun.
Right.
So it's not going to end that way for her. And that's a bigger challenge for me, and I love that challenge. It's got to be, I think, a smart ending and an ending that makes sense to the loyal reader.
That's a sensible answer. You know, before we close, you have had a long, successful career punctuated by pitfalls that we've all faced at one time or another. What do you consider your greatest success and legacy?
I think, for me, without question, it's the work that I did building the sex crimes unit in the Manhattan DA's office from a point in time when the laws didn't work. We had a lot to do with changing the laws from the initial changes in the 70s to many that we helped author and lobby for. And the whole attitude that this chambermaid can come forward today and accuse one of the most powerful men in the world could not have happened in the 1970s. And I really think the people with whom I work shoulder to shoulder, this little team of both prosecutors and police detectives, really changed the map for how victims of sex crimes and domestic violence are treated, not only in New York, but in all of the places in the country that have modeled their work on us. I have just enormous pride when I look back on what my colleagues did with me in that unit. We were a little band, a hearty little band. We, you know, nobody did
a
alone.
Band of brothers.
But,
and a sister.
Yes. It's just an extraordinary change from 1976 when I took over the unit to what prosecutors all over the country can do now, and that's a change for victims. I don't mean it's the success of the prosecutors,
right,
but it's victims being able to report these crimes and get justice.
You know, in our closing moments, you just came back from a grueling book tour. Is this grind one of the toughest parts of being a successful writer, something you still enjoy, or would you like to avoid it if possible in the future?
I love it. Silent Mercy was the newest book, and I went to about 14 cities. Many writers prefer the silence of the writing room, and not. It's. I think it's the prosecutor in me who likes the books being out of the boxes and talking to people about what works. You know, I think, Richard, we're seeing the end of it. I now that so many people are moving to e-books, I don't know how many people will be coming out to get books signed and inscribed and talk about them anymore.
Well,
and
they might want to meet people, you know. I met Robert Dallek last night at the New York Historical Society, had him sign a couple of my old books, and it was great. I always try to go there, and I always bring the books. I want them signed. You know?
Nice. I mean, that's what I look forward to, and I learn so much from readers. They tell you who they want to see,
right,
and what, you know, give me suggestions about where to go in New York. So it's a very important dynamic for me, and I'm one of the writers who just loves the grueling book tour.
Well, you know, that's interesting, and you seem to be counterculture on many of the assumptions that one can make. You know, I want to thank you, Linda, for joining us today, and also I want to extend a happy birthday to your husband, a character in many of your books, Justin Feldman, one of the great lawyers and publicly minded Americans that this country has been blessed with.
Thank
you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard, and thanks for that special happy birthday, too.
Thank you.
Okay.
My pleasure. Next week, I'll be discussing the media, Madison Avenue, and the Republican hopefuls, wannabes, and has-beens with political commentator Ann Cook. She's been with us before. She's great. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com. where information on my guests will be posted. And by the way, as I'll report, the sun is out today for the first time I can remember in a while. Thank you very much, Linda Fairstein, for joining us. Be well. Bye-bye.